So it's nice that Andre talked about sensory systems, because I'm going to talk about a very interesting sensory system, which is the olfactory system in insects. And the problem I'm going to talk about today is about gain control in insects. And it's an important problem because when an insect is looking for food, it's tracking gradients. And in the process of reaching the target, it's detecting different odor concentrations. Nevertheless, still the insect is able to detect that it's the same odor. So that's the one interesting problem. How is it possible that the system is able to keep that that same message all the time, regardless of different odor concentrations through this process? I usually, when I talk about insects, I get this flat reaction from the audience. So I want to get some, explain a little bit about the interest on these things. Because nowadays, there is a good bunch of technology that can move this field forward in set of action, because there is a lot of work in, for example, in genetic manipulation, where they can manipulate these things and actually, for example, do things like turning off neurons by temperature. So they can actually test different hypotheses and theories quite quickly in a very fancy way. They also have all these multi-unit recordings, and they have also, you know, another important issue, which is behavioral experiments. So they can test these animals. They can test how smart they are by testing different authors and see whether these things can learn it. So it's a system where I would expect that there will be a lot of progress in the future. So the goal I have here is about pattern recognition. I want to identify how these insects do the pattern recognition problem. But obviously, one long-term project is determine how time and dynamical systems play a role here. And I'm going to take a different angle. Lisa was not very happy with this angle, but I like to take this different angle. So I like to start from basic ideas of pattern recognition that do not take into account the time. Things like organization, number of neurons, connectivity, location of plasticity, and so on. And then from there, move ahead and see you know, when time starts to be important or not. So that's kind of the plan, but it's a very long-term project. So we are still long distance from that. So my background is I deal and work for quite a few years in pattern recognition problems. So I like to take this angle, and I think it might be useful for you guys. So I like to take it like this. So how an engineer tackles this, like dealing, let's say, with digit recognition? How do they do it? So the first thing they need to do is this feature extraction of the input space. So they need to determine textures or edge shapes. In the case of the visual system, it's not so clear, for example, for the olfactory system. And then they apply some techniques that are pretty well known, that are machine learning techniques, typical that are artificial neural networks, very, very popular now, super vector machines and so on. So I want to get to this point, right? Which is for engineers, the feature extraction part is extremely difficult, because usually they need to try one thing, analyze the statistics of the input space, see how you can do a better factorization of the input space. And that's not easy. The part that is easier is the machine learning part. So once they have well separated the input space, they can go ahead and do some classification on learning. So once I said that, I'm going to start describing this very interesting system, which is the olfactory system of insects, right? So let's start from the very beginning. The information, the molecules attached to the olfactory receptors here, which in the case of the locus, there are like 90,000 receptors. Then this information is transmitted to this small area antenna lobe that Peter was talking this morning, which has, in the case of the locus, around 2,000 neurons. 1,200 neurons. And this is my idea is that this area is where the feature extraction in the animal takes place. Once there is this strong convergence of information into this small area, which is sometimes called the first relay station, then all this information is transmitted towards the mushroom body, which is a very interesting area of the insect brain that people that work in this thing for many years, they call it the hippocampus of insects. And in this area, you know, again, as I said, there are like 1,000 neurons here, 90,000 here, 1,000 here. And when it goes to this level over here, then there are again 50,000 neurons. So there is this process of convergence and divergence where, you know, it goes from a lot of activity here, a smaller activity here, and very sparse activity. So that's well known and well recorded. So they know this pretty well. And that happens across different types of insects. What else? Once this is projected to this huge screen, which is the mushroom body, the canyon cell, this goes into this lobula, this what is called the mushroom body lobes, where here is believed where the learning is taking place. So there is a bunch of other conditioning experiments, mainly coming from Europe now, France and Germany, where they can really track the location of learning to this area of the insect brain. So that's why this indicates that in this area there is some feature extraction, so separation of the input and in the important features of the input. And then there is this area over there, which is the machine learning part. So the way, okay, let's, a few remarks here, which are interesting for us. You know, the bad news is that actually this phase of the antenna law, the projection from the antenna to the antenna law, that's genetically pre-wired. There's a very little change. It's true that there are some reports of some changes, synaptic changes, but it's mostly pre-wired. Very few changes happen. And nevertheless, the part where there is known there is a lot of changing is in the mushroom body lobes. So this is this is experimental evidence. So the bad news regarding this point is that the feature extraction that happens to be the most complicated one for engineers, it happens to be developed in many millions of years. So it's interesting. So let's say a few things here about spatial temporal code for moving ahead. And here, there is no question, there are so many papers already, that there is a spatiotemporal activity. So this has been shown in moth, this has been shown in honeybee, obviously in locusts with Joe Laurent, who we collaborate a lot, and it has been shown in many, many different places. So nobody's questioning that there is a spatiotemporal activity there. And nevertheless, regarding the mushroom body, it's known that the activity is very sparse, so they don't fire very much. And it appears that in this area, the spatiotemporal activity is not that present. So, you know, it's interesting that this is kind of separating different spatiotemporal patterns. And at the end, this one is now looking at all these patterns, looking at a few of them, some given. So, as I said before, I'm electric. Electric fish.
Sounds like an insect.
Yeah.
No.
You are too close to the microphone.
Okay. Okay, I can speak in Morse now. So, Peter, shall I continue?
Yeah.
Okay, so as I said earlier, I'm going to start from this basic machine learning concepts, and I'm going to ask a few questions. Oh, this is really annoying.
That's
a great
idea.
You can hear me anyways, right?
Well, we record the audio for later.
Oh, sorry. That's it. I have 5 minutes back, right?
There's someone coming to sort it.
Okay. Here we go. Try again. So, as I said earlier, I'll start from basic principles of machine learning and see how different types of connectivity, proportion of neurons, local synaptic plasticity and inhibition can lead to proper other classification or recognition in the insect brain. So I take all this data that is out there that we get through the collaboration with GLM and some communications to other people. And then we go ahead and do this analysis. This is the work we already published in Neural Computation. Nevertheless, it's important for the message of the paper. So, you know, the basic ideas are not new, because this was actually developed in different ways, shapes, colors, and forms by these people actually here in Cambridge. And David Marr died quite early, but he got it here while he was in the Trinity College. So basically, all these guys already show that sparse activity is extremely important to achieve, you know, good properties for learning associative memory. So somehow the same ideas are there and kind of expanded and applied to the real system of the to the insect olfactory system. So this is the basic idea. It was kind of mentioned by Peter this morning, very quickly. But so in this earlier stage, given that in here there is no spatiotemporal activity, the recognition here doesn't appear to have that, we're going to take like a snapshot of the activity in the antenna lobe. Here we project this information into this area of the Marsden body, which is the calyx, and which has a bunch of neurons named the Kinion cells. And something that is clear from the theoretical analysis that's in the neural computation is that there is not really any need for learning or adjustment of the connections in this area. So the important part is here. So once you have some sparse activity in this layer, then it's much easier to separate it by hyperplanes. And why I say hyperplanes? Because these neurons, basically what they do are separating this other encoded stimulus in the mushroom body, detecting by a threshold. So whenever they receive, these neurons receive sufficient synaptic input, they will fire. And that's equivalent to having a hyperplane separating the representation in the Marsden body lobe. So the only place where we need learning is in these connections over here. And this is learning actually it's all right to have heavier learning here to make it work. So it's basically kind of readjusting all ideas that were in David Marr and Rich and others. The other thing that we need to have in here to be able to classify is some sort of competition between the output neurons that do the classification, such that, you know, at the end you have one group of neurons representing one type of stimulus. So in here we need inhibition, mutual inhibition, so there is some sort of competition. So those are the basic elements. Well, this is a cartoon of what's the basic idea, but I have this mostly for biologists, but for you guys, I think I'll go quickly. Let's assume that we have different inputs in antenna lobe, four inputs, and we want to separate it into classes, class one and class two. We pass it into antenna lobe coordinates, and the idea is to find a way to separate these by hyperplanes, right, these classes. So this is obvious that in this 2D, this is not possible to do, no matter how you put this. There is no way to do it. So what's the basic idea? You move it to the kind of cell coordinates into a higher dimension, which is the basic idea of David Marr and many other people working in linear learning machines. And once you put it in this higher dimension, it's much easier to find a hyperplane that is able to separate both classes. That's it, basically. So I'll go quick on through this. Basically, the problem that we solve in neural computation is to have a bunch of orders. And what we want to see is how well the system is able to discriminate orders into different classes. And the result, there are many results, but the one I want to emphasize today is that here we have the probability of having the proper discrimination. And here is the number of active Kenyon cells. Well, I didn't put it properly, but there are like 50,000 neurons. So the main message here, well, these different lines correspond to different n's, where n is the number of stimulus. And the important message here is that we have a sharp area where the probability discrimination drops very quickly. So basically, we are very contained. We are contained to this small area of activity of the Kenyon cells to be able to do the proper classification. If we do some other type of analysis, like capacity, how many others are able to discriminate, and this is actually not for locus. This is actually for Drosophila, which is smaller in size. And so it's only 5,000, sorry. And the thing is also, it goes to a peak where near the very, very sparse activity in the case of the Drosophila. So this is not striking because there are these experiments of locust and in honeybee. This honeybee's experiment was quite recent in Journal of Neurophysiology. But both of these in different insects show that the activity, sparse activity in the mushroom body is around 1%. So it's quite consistent with what I get. So this is the main message right now to move into the gain control issues. There is this need of having a gain control in the input. So there is not a major failure in classification. So we need to find a way to do this in the right way. So let's go back to the, and now we forgot about this. The main message is that we need a sparse activity here, and we need some mechanisms in this network of antenna lobe such that we have a sparse activity being communicated into the mushroom body. Now, they passed me the data from locust. Let me go quickly for different orders. This is the mean firing rate in antenna. So these guys, what they do, they have tetral recordings. And then they are able to identify like 14 neurons. And then by spike sorting algorithms. So in that way, they have like a rasters of activity for 14 neurons for each of the others. So then I went ahead with those rasters that they gave me. They didn't give me the raw data. But the rasters. And something like this number over here is the concentration level. So this is a log scale. So this is the vapor pressure, basically. So they put this in a vial, different concentrations of the other. And this is the concentration level. So it's a 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 4, and so on. And the main message is here. So the stronger the other concentration, you know, doesn't matter. We still have like constant firing rate activity during the stimulus. You go across different orders, you kind of find consistently the same type of results. These error bars is that correspond to variability across trials. An important thing is that these neurons actually can fire all the way up to 100 hertz. So the first thing that comes to mind when regarding gain control issues is that, they just go to the maximum and that's it, they stop. No, this is not the case here. They just go to, usually to 10 hertz or 6 or 8 hertz, but never to the maximum, which is 100 hertz. The other interesting thing is that they usually have this baseline activity of 3 or 4 hertz. And but this is mainly coming from the sensor system, from the antenna. So if they cut the antenna, this goes flat. So they know but that's something that the insect is working all the time with it. So it needs to handle that noisy stimulus. So now to put things in, you know, to be as honest as possible, those results are so used for the locust, but now it seems that in the honeybee, Galicia's group, which is in Riverside, and now it's moving back to Germany, he got different results. So it seems that honeybee and locust seems to have different results. So here's basically the same thing as before. This is the concentration level. And this is the, what is PN signal is the output neurons from the excitatory neurons from the antenna block. So what this shows actually is that for increasing other concentrations, he sees that there is an increasing activity in the output of the antenna block. Now, here is a little bit of controversy because he's not measuring by tetrode recording, he's doing calcium imaging. And there is some discussion about how you have to take the calcium image. What's the relationship between the calcium image and the firing rate? He claims that this is quite accurate to the firing rate. So he says that actually the firing rate is going up. So this is an issue to be resolved. Nevertheless, let's say the following. When they analyze anatomically the mushroom body of the honeybee, it seems that there are some local circuits within the mushroom bodies. So it might be that in the honeybee, there is another mechanism controlling doing the gain control right in the calyx.
So what distinguishes the different curves here? Sorry.
These are different neurons.
Oh,
different. So they are able to target different outgoing neurons. And so that's the situation right now. So it's not that clear. Nevertheless, I'm gonna concentrate on the locus problem because that's the data I have, and I still don't understand very well how the other one works. So to understand this, I got into these mean firing rate models. Basically, this function, this is the firing rate for the excitatory population and for the inhibitory population. I have these gain functions, which for the firing rate, and basically I'm taking here the flat curve, and then it reaches a threshold, and then any function, any increasing function. Right now, I don't care about the specifics of this P and PI. These two functions. The thing that I want to concentrate the most is in here, in the connectivities. So I want to look for those connectivities such that it's possible to get gain control for increasing other concentrations. So I'll be concentrating in these connectivity weights. These thresholds right now are not that important. The important idea is that given that there is this constant stimulus coming from the antenna, you need to keep some overall activity in the system. But that's not what I care the most. I care about how these have to look, these connectivity matrices. So to get some grip onto this system, I'm going to go into a mean field description. When you start doing simulations of these things, you know, it gets very slow. So I don't want to call this a theory, although I want to be more humble, and I want to call this more like a tool to understand better my system. And so I divide the system into four types, the excitatory neurons, the inhibitory neurons, and then I'm going to divide those ones that receive inputs, this set over here, and the set that do not receive inputs. So there are four classes around here. An important parameter for me is this alpha over here, which is the percentage of neurons that receive input. So then I apply mean field, and then I have the question about how to determine this function. We'll go to that later. Then I define a new set of variables. And defining this set of variables, I skip here. I didn't put this transparency. But I need to assume that this is Derrida. I use the Derrida-Poumont approximation, which an alien approximation, which basically states that the connections are randomized. So the connections are obtained from a Bernoulli process. We'll get into that later. So by assuming that, I can go into these two parameters, which is the probability of connections from the excitatory population into the inhibitory population, and the strength of the connectivity. And this is a new variable, and this is obviously a number of neurons, excitatory neurons, number of inhibitory neurons. And as I said before, X1 for the ones that receive input, X2 for the ones that do not receive input, and the, other, the same for the other. So then by doing that, I get this compact mean field equations that I'm going to analyze. It's not my goal to analyze the bifurcations here at this point. I'm going to use this fact. So it's known that the connectivity antenna log between the excitatory neurons is very small, or zero. Actually, they never detected one. So I'm going to look for this condition over here, which is I'm going to take the fixed point of this model, and I'm going to make sure that for any value of the intensity and for any value of the percentage of neurons that receive input, the activity is going to be constant. So that's the gain control condition. Now, I'm going to consider this a stable fixed point because that's I don't have the movie here, but it seems quite clear in many different experiments that the antenna lobe works in a transient. And Mises' idea is that it's a winnerless competition principle. So that's close enough, but it's not proved yet. So whenever the input comes, it goes through a kind of complicated trajectory, and a matter of a second, it reaches a fixed point. And it's interesting because they repeat this stimulation several times, and it always follows the same trajectory. So I'm concentrating only on the stable fixed point. So by applying this condition, what you get is this gain control condition, you know, where this composite derivative is explained here, is evaluated in these different points. So these different points correspond to the neurons that receive the input and the neurons that do not receive the input. So I can explain that a little bit better later for those of you who are interested. So, okay, so what's the interesting conclusion from this gain control condition is that that the gain control mostly depends on the inhibitory connections. So the excitatory are kind of free. But inhibitory connections are the important one to keep the system under control. And the other problem, the other interesting thing is that this condition is going to work as long as these gain functions that I showed you before are linear. Now, you go to simulations, and you calculate these gain functions in the mean field model. Actually, you're not working there or in that area. Actually, most of the time the system is working in this area. So there is around 3 or 4 hertz of activation. And then, so it's working in this curve area. So I got these results from simulations. I fit to this function over here that comes from convoluting these linear functions from the simulations with a Gaussian. And then I fit that. And then this is those conditions, what you're saying is that pretty much that the relationship between the inhibitory connectivity into the inhibitory and the excitatory population has this relationship. Now, if I go back to the simulations and I run this is not very detailed simulations that I need to populate more. But nevertheless, already pointing out that, you know, the area where the probability a connection from the inhibitory, the excitatory 0.5 in here. So you can see that whenever this is starting to be flat, which is the goal, this is for different stimulus input concentration, is nearby, you know, 0.25. So kind of consistent with that. So these are a few conclusions that I got from here, which is, you know, that gain control can actually be implemented in a reasonable way in antenna law. And the interesting thing is just can be controlled by using just the inhibitory connection. So you have the excitatory ones to do some other things. The things to do in here, you know, something it's not enough to have the gain control condition. Something I didn't check yet, that would be interesting if we have some time, is that to make sure that for different order concentration, the activation, the set of neurons that activate in antenna law are actually the same. So still it's not enough as a result. So let me say thank you to all these people, the people in in Caltech that pass the data, and all these collaborators, especially to my dear friend, Isa.
That's all.